This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. An ex-prisoner of war, 84-year-old Kenneth Eaton of Clovis, California, is our guest this time around.
But back during the Korean War, he didn't think he'd live to see 22 or 23 or 24. Didn't think he'd meet a wife someday, have four kids, 10 grandkids, 11 great-grandkids. But that was God's plan for him, and he can look back and see a lot of close calls, many more than most of us can count on our hands. We're going to talk about some more of those and talk more about his book, Missing Dog Tags. If you want to get it, you can go to Barnes & Noble online or go to Amazon.com. And let's get back to his story now. You talked about the horrors of that 250-mile death march, the starvation, the freezing cold, the strafing by American planes. We've also talked about the mistreatment that you received from your captors. They also wanted to indoctrinate you and convince you that communism was the best way. How did you take to that, this attempted indoctrination? They had you watch films, read books, listen to lectures. Did you kind of just shrug it off? How did you deal with that?
The lectures were at least twice a week in the camp I was in. When I finally got on the Yalu River, they had a real large building made with an auditorium with a deck on it, a stage in the far end of it. And you could probably get 300 or more of us in there, and they would rotate. They had us in this camp, had us segregated by race, by rank, and country for indoctrination. They didn't want the officers with enlisted men. They didn't want the higher rank sergeants with corporals and privates, and they segregated the black from the white, and the Spanish and Latin American people from everyone else. They even mixed them with Hawaiian, as I recall. And they would indoctrinate us in this couple of times a week if they could rotate the camp through this building that fast. At that time, there was about 1,500 in the camp I was in. There had originally been about 5,000, and the death rate on my death march that I endured. But the same thing was happening in this camp. There had been about 5,000 there, and half the camp had died off at a rate of 30 or 40 a day in the winter of 50 into 51 when I was on the death march. Anyway, the indoctrination, you had to set up. You better pay attention. They did give tests. They weren't extensive, but you had to pay attention. They would read things about and explain about Marxism and Engels and Stalinism and Mao Zedong. Seemed like everybody had written something about communism, and they wanted us all to have an understanding of that and how great it was for China and how great it had been for the Russians. And if you didn't answer some of the questions properly when they had a test a day or two later, you didn't eat for a day or two or three, or you may be thrown in a vegetable hole up by the kitchen with a bucket of water dumped over you for two or three days. And some guys didn't survive that in those, even that time of the year, because of freezing at night. Or they'd make you stand outside and dump water on you until you decided you wanted to pay attention and pass their test and pretend like you were believing some of the things they tried to teach you about communism.
And I don't want to stray too far from your individual experience, but when you step back and you look at the big picture, with that in mind, everything you just described about the way they tried to indoctrinate you, the way they wanted things to be, the way that you were treated, keeping in mind that the Korean War still technically isn't over, there's still the demilitarized zone there on the 38th parallel. Do you ever step back and say, you know, it was really important what Americans did there, because had we let them have their way, that our world would look a whole lot different tonight? Did that give you a glimpse of the world they wanted to come about?
Yes. The spread of communism, if they could have taken over South Korea, then their next step would have been Japan. And with the Chinese, the many millions, they have more there than the rest of the Asian nations around them there. They perhaps would have been able to do that. And we might have been fighting a different kind of war today. The spread of communism, but our defense of freedom with the Russians and with the Chinese And with the North Koreans, it's stalemated. We haven't gone anywhere beyond that, but we've stopped them also.
And one of the best illustrations I've had shared with me over the years, if people don't get that and don't see the importance of the Korean War, is that nighttime satellite photo of the Korean Peninsula. Have you seen that with South Korea all lit up and North Korea completely pitch black?
Yeah, South Korea looks like San Diego, and it's wonderful to know that.
And it wouldn't look like that without the sacrifices that you and so many other veterans of that era made. Ken Eaton is our guest. He was a prisoner of war for 2.5 years in Korea during the 1950s. He's written about it in his book, Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. You can find that online. Go to our website, kmjnow.com, for more details about that. As time goes on, I imagine there's part of you that becomes more hopeful and another part of you that becomes less hopeful, that if you've been in captivity all this time, the chances of you eventually succumbing the way so many around you have are increasing. But you had some hope. I know this because several times along the way, you took out a little spiral notebook and scribbled some notes in English, hoping that some of the civilians in the area would get those notes out and that they'd find their way back home. Did any of those notes make it home? Were your parents, was your family able to find out that you were indeed alive and not dead over there?
Yeah, yes, I had a little blue spiral notebook and a ballpoint pen my mother had included in a belated Christmas present that came to me while I was over there. And I started writing notes, giving my name, rank, serial number, my company, 2nd Division, 9th Tank. Please notify my company commander and the Air Force to stop bombing the villages. They're killing us. And please notify my mother and father. And 7 or 8 of those, when I come home, they'd gone through the War Department, and my mother and father had them in a scrapbook to show me.
And I don't want to gloss over anything, so if there's something you think is important to mention before we get to that moment, feel free. But I don't want to miss out on what that felt like to you to finally be a free man again, because here you've been beaten, you've been tortured, you've starved, you've frozen, you've been shot at by your own airplanes, and yet it's still possible for you to survive all this and to be a free man again. How did that come about? And what did that feel like?
Well, it was the most wonderful thing that you could ever experience for a person like me and those with me. When we were hauled, taken from the camp on a train, and then unloaded and hauled by trucks to a village nearby Panmunjom, where we were to be traded, one American soldier for maybe 2,000 Chinese or Koreans, because we had our army had captured that many more of them than the Chinese had left of us. Anyway, when the truck I was in was backed into Panmunjom and I was unloaded from the back of the truck, all I could see was 10 Marines in starched uniforms standing in a row. And God, we just couldn't wait to get out and touch one of them with our hands to prove to ourselves that we were free. We were free at last, and it wasn't going to be another trick.
Because you had seen plenty of those along the way. And to get back to the States, you dedicate this book to your mother and her prayers to see her again. What was that moment like?
Well, that was wonderful. My mother and my father, they met me at San Francisco when we come in a ship, and we spent some wonderful days just being together, and my brothers and sister and my sister-in-laws, and it was just wonderful. It was still hard to believe that I really was back in America on American soil. It took me weeks to trying things out and smelling things and looking at things and to believe that I really was back in America.
I can't imagine going through what you went through, and your book spells it out, like I said, in vivid detail, all the things that you endured. I can't imagine having that experience and that experience not changing your perspective a little bit. Did you find yourself back in the States trying to find some idea of a normal life again, taking less for granted or having a little different outlook on things because of what you'd been through?
Yes, I did. I had a terrible outlook on life at first, thinking every day, like I did when I was a prisoner of war, that tomorrow may not come, may never come. But little by little, I melted back into daily life. It took some months, but I melted back into daily life and learned to pick up where I had left off or been with my family prior to my going in the service. And it took several years, I'm sure, that before I was 100%, but I am there now. Thank God.
Amen. And a couple other things I want to talk to you about before we close out the program. You have medals displayed here in your home in Clovis, and one medal is missing that I think anybody who reads your book and sees what you went through, how you were wounded when your tank was blown up and also beaten and hurt badly in captivity, there's no Purple Heart up there. And it's not because you don't deserve it. You decided that you couldn't handle having it because of what else you saw. Explain to me that reasoning, why you didn't feel worthy of the Purple Heart.
Well, I, from the time capture and the death march and all the wounded and the ones who died from their wounds and the ones we tried to help along the trail at night to carry them until finally they succumbed to their wounds. And the things I seen and lived with in the main camp when I finally got there, almost a year later, the different 17-year-olds and 35-year-olds with missing legs and shot in the face and arms missing and almost anything you can imagine, I couldn't accept a Purple Heart after being with those kind of people.
Well, I think everybody hears you loud and clear. And finally, we have this book today, but I mentioned you wrote this book more than 50 years ago, and there were times where you thought about having it published before. It didn't work out for whatever reason, but you'd had it buried among things here and hadn't thought of it for quite some time, I understand. And it's your family that convinced you to pick it back up again, and that's why we have this book today. Tell me how that came about, and I guess what emotion that leaves you with now.
Well, I after two attempts to get it published in the early years, I just it was considered to be too harsh of an experience for publishing companies, and so I just gave up on it. But my family continued, especially my wife and my children. They wanted the book published, not only for people to find out what happened in Korea, but for my children too, for them to have information about what their father had gone through. It's been a relief to have this happen, to have the book published.
Well, and your family won't be the only people who benefit from reading this story and understanding what can happen in a time of war and what things, what experiences, what horrific atrocities some Americans have gone through for the sake of freedom. It gives us a lot less to take for granted, and hopefully it gives us a lot of respect and admiration for those who put their lives on the line for us every day. Veterans Day, when it rolls around every year, I know it's your birthday, but in the bigger picture, what does Veterans Day mean to you?
Well, it's my birthday. It's my birthday, but I do celebrate Veterans Day for all of those great guys who was in the Second World War that did so much for our country and previous wars and the wars that's going on today, the young fellows that's out there that's sacrificing their life and coming home wounded, missing limbs. Veterans Day is a great day, and we should all hold those fellows up high.
Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for everything that you went through and for having the courage to go back there emotionally and share that story with us so we can understand. Is there anything else that you want our listeners to know?
No, I think if I would appreciate it so that my experience is told around the country. If you have a friend, tell them about the book. I think especially if they're a veteran, and those who aren't veterans will appreciate it, what I've tried to tell you about it, about what happened in Korea.
Absolutely. And again, that book is Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. Kenneth Eaton is the author. It's been 60 years now since he regained his freedom after spending that brutal, horrifying time in captivity. We typically hear from World War II veterans on Hometown Heroes, but I can't imagine anybody getting your attention more
or sharing more mind-blowing stories than what this Korean War veteran, Kenneth Eaton, has shared with us in this program. The Korean War has been called, quite aptly, the Forgotten War. It happened so soon after World War II and, of course, ahead of the more controversial war in Vietnam. But let's not forget the price paid in the Korean War. More than 54,000 Americans died, 103,000 were wounded, roughly 4,000, like Kenneth Eaton, became prisoners. Think about those numbers in relation to your hometown and its population and reflect on that significance. Thanks to Mr. Eaton for a little perspective today. Remember, you can always find photos related to our guests by liking Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook. Tell your friends to do the same, and more importantly, when given the opportunity, make sure you honor those who have served and help us all remember that freedom is not free.